morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and as usual, we are on the air live for a half hour each weekday. This being Friday, it's the last weekday this week, so your last opportunity before the weekend to get on the program. If you have something you'd like to bring up, something you'd like to ask, if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or the Christian life or about your own spiritual walk, or your spiritual journey and quest, we can talk together here. If you have a different viewpoint than that of the host, you're welcome to dialogue with me here as well. The number is 1-800-227-5278. The lines are open right now, so you can reach me at 1-800-227-5278. Anyone who's listening who might be in the Las Vegas area on the weekend, I will be speaking in Las Vegas, actually Henderson, Nevada, right next to Las Vegas, tomorrow afternoon. I'm going to be talking about the subject toward a radically Christian counterculture. Yeah, you've been hearing that a lot because that's a series, and I'm only teaching one lecture per month. So we've been stretching out the announcements about that for several months now. Anyway, if you're going to be in the Las Vegas area, you can check our website for time and location. And there's also a potluck meal if you want to come for that. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Strangely, we have no calls waiting, and so, of course, my announcing that might cause them to all fill up. Sometimes people just assume, well, I couldn't get on if I tried. You can. In most cases, we almost always have at least one line open, although sometimes all the lines are full. Anyway, the number to call is 1-800-227-5278. And Rebecca wrote in and asked, do you believe that emotional abuse provides grounds for divorce? And that's actually a question that comes up from time to time. It's very hard to answer because it's hard to know what is meant by emotional abuse. If anything that's abusive or unkind and isn't physical, but let's say it's mainly verbal or something like that, if that's what we're talking about is emotional abuse, I'm not sure that it would be legitimate grounds for divorce. Obviously, if a spouse doesn't have the grace to endure something, it might be that some kind of distance being put between the abuser and the abused for a period of time to see if things get better might be an option in some cases. But frankly, I think that when people say they want to get divorced because of emotional abuse, I hate to say it, and if you're one of those, I don't mean to insult you, but it's just my impression, I think it's kind of wimpy. I mean, it's like saying my faithfulness to keep my vow depends on whether others treat me the way I want to be treated and the way I feel emotionally tolerable. I mean, what if we ask the same question, is emotional abuse for being a Christian grounds for ceasing to be a Christian? In other words, if my faithfulness to Christ is contingent on how well I'm treated by other people, then maybe my faithfulness to my wedding vows should be contingent on that too. But I don't think it should be. I think that when you sign up, as it were, to be a follower of Christ, you're making a lifelong commitment, and it's more or less for better or for worse. And the same is true when you sign up for marriage. You actually say that you're making a lifelong commitment. when we come to Christ, a lot of times we don't verbalize all the things that really are implied. I'm doing this for life. I'm coming to Christ for the rest of my life and for all eternity. It doesn't matter how I get treated. It doesn't matter how much persecution I receive. I'm in. I'm in for the duration. We don't say all that, but all of that is implied when we come to Christ, if we're truly coming to Christ. But we actually say those things verbally when we get married. We say, I'm in this until one of us is dead. This is for better, for worse, for richer, for poor. And in others, we are definitely consciously signing up for faithfulness, regardless what happens. And therefore, I don't want to sound like somebody who's aloof from this. I have experienced emotional abuse in marriage, thankfully not in my present marriage, but in past marriage, I have been definitely subjected to what I think by any definition would be called emotional abuse, but it never crossed my mind that breaking my wedding vows was somehow an option. You know, I think Christians have lost sight of the value of a little thing called integrity. Integrity means you can be trusted to do what you say you'll do, that you've got something in your character that would rather die than compromise. Now, you might say, I can't relate with that. Well, I'm sorry. You're a newfangled person. It used to be that people cared about their integrity. I can see by the ease with which people seek divorces today that integrity is not really valued very much. But you have to realize that when you surrender your integrity on any point, you surrender it on all points. Jesus said, he that is faithful in what is least is faithful in that which is much. And he said the same thing about being unfaithful. He that is unfaithful in that which is least will be unfaithful in that which is much. And therefore, a little bit of compromise of your integrity really ends up being a total compromise of your character. And that means you lose trust. In my opinion, if you made vows that said you'd stay with your partner and they gave you no valid grounds for divorce and you divorced them anyway, what you've said is, I don't care about my integrity. You're basically announcing to the world, don't trust me. I won't keep my promises. And, you know, if it sounds like I've got some emotional attachment to this view, obviously I do. And so, but I am asked this quite a bit, is emotional abuse grounds for divorce? I don't see any biblical reason why it should be. Jesus was verbally abused, and he didn't, you know, he wasn't dissuaded from his path that he was on. And when you're married, you're on a path that God has assigned for you to be faithful. And so, you know, you don't just give up your integrity and your faithfulness because it's hard. I hope. If you do, then what are you going to do if you're persecuted for your faith? I say we got wimpy Christians these days. It's not a surprise we got wimpy non-Christians, but we're not allowed to be wimpy Christians. We need to actually have some integrity, some backbone, and stand by what we say. Let's talk to David from San Diego. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Hi.
You said a couple minutes ago that you're going to Las Vegas, and I was just going to ask you, when you go to Las Vegas, do you ever get tempted to stop at a casino to play blackjack or slot machines, that type of thing?
You know, to tell you the truth, the presence of casinos in Las Vegas is the one thing that makes the place make me feel sick when I go there. I've never had the slightest temptation to go to a casino. I've actually been in casinos because people, friends there, have taken me to dinner in restaurants that were in casinos. But walking through the casino to get to the restaurant, I look at people and I think, what makes these people tick? I can't imagine wanting to do what they're doing there. Now, I don't mean to say I'm a saint. I mean, I've definitely had my sins and my temptations. I've got my areas of carnality. But gambling, that's one of the few sins I've never had a temptation toward at all. It's just stupid. But, I mean, obviously the things that I'm tempted to do are stupid, too. I'm not saying I'm better than other people. But the answer is no. I have never had the slightest urge to gamble. I actually value my money more than that. What's that?
What about lottery tickets?
Never bought one. Can't imagine doing it. I believe that money is supposed to be earned. That's kind of a biblical principle. Ever since the fall, God told mankind that he'd have to work for a living, and the New Testament confirms this. Those who will not work will not eat. Of course, a lot of people who gamble might also work, but obviously they're hoping to increase their assets without much work. When it comes to gambling, I don't have any of that in me. I don't have any interest in getting more money. I don't have any interest in losing money, and I wouldn't find the game a fun thing to do. So there's really nothing in the whole scene that would do anything for me. But I realize there's people who have, you know, temptations that way that are probably as strong in them as my own temptations are toward other things. But, just to answer your question, no, Las Vegas holds no allures to me.
Do you, like, Public Service Clearinghouse sent you something in the mail where you can win $1 million, do you fill that out and send it in, or do you do that type of thing?
No, I'm not fooled by those things. No, I mean, if God wants me to have $1 million, he knows where I am and he knows where to find it. You know, from time to time, I've lived by faith for 40-something years, and I've seen that if there's a need, God knows how to provide it, you know. And sometimes, on rare occasions, even very large gifts have come out of totally unpredictable places. And although that doesn't happen all the time, the fact that it has happened sometime just confirms to me that God knows where the money is. And if I need money, God knows where to find me and where to find somebody who's got the money who wants to give it. I don't have to ask. I don't even have to ask. Well, I have to ask God, but I don't have to ask people. So, I don't know. I'm on a different page than that. If you said, you know, how would you like $1 million? All you have to do is compromise in some little way. That's not what would tempt me. I might be tempted by other things, but not money. I don't really know what I'd do with $1 million. I'm sure I could find a use for it, but I imagine most of it would go out to charities because I don't have. It's like the Bible says, be content with such things as you have. I can't imagine anything that I would want that would cost even the smallest fraction of that. So anyway, you know, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm trying to sound saintly because I'm trying to give all kinds of disclaimers about that. I'm not saintly. I've got as many problems probably as anybody has, just not that particular problem. All right. Let's talk to Alan from Escondido next. Alan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a fairly new Christian, and I got turned on to all these books by a friend after I accepted the Lord, and they're like the Left Behind series and some books by Hal mm-hmm. Lindsey and Jack Van Impe and stuff, and really kind of getting into the prophecy thing. And I was wondering, a lot of it's talking about this pre-trib rapture theory, and I've been studying my Bible along with these books, and I can't seem to put it together as I don't see where this teaching is really coming from. It sounds good,
I say stick with your instincts about that. Trust your instincts. Because the books you mentioned are all, you know, high-powered advocates of the pre-trib rapture. But I agree with you. When I read the Bible, I'm not seeing it there. Now, what's interesting, he just jumped off. Actually, both of our callers kind of hung up in the midst of the conversation, but that's okay. Maybe you just felt like you got your question out. I myself believed and taught the pre-trib rapture when I was a young teacher in my teens and early 20s, just because that's the view I was raised with. I read Hal Lindsey too, and I read and heard many teachers who presented the arguments. So I actually learned the arguments for the pre-trib rapture and could defend it very well. In fact, to tell you the truth, nowadays when I read books by Jack Van Impe or Tim LaHaye, I think I could defend the pre-trib rapture better than they can, because they don't do an excellent job, in my opinion. And I think I could do better. I've done it in the past. But the thing is that as I got older and studied more, I just realized that the arguments were shallow. They were ignoring context. They were bringing many presuppositions into the passage that were not stated. And what I later came out with, I had 19 or 20 biblical arguments for the pre-trib rapture. When I was in my 20s, my early 20s, I had either 19 or 20 biblical arguments that I could marshal off the top of my head to defend the pre-trib rapture. I could still do it. But what happened is eventually I looked at those very carefully and critically and realized that none of them was a valid argument. None of them really was an exegetical treatment of any of the verses in the Bible. So over time, I had to give up that view and go back to the historic Christian view. You know, the pre-trib rapture was introduced in 1830. Before that, Christians never believed it. And now I don't believe it either. So I say trust your instincts on that. You're reading your Bible, and you're reading these popular books, and you're thinking the Bible doesn't agree with the popular books. Go with the Bible. Don't go with popular books. Okay? I appreciate your call, brother. And Vince from Chino Hills is next. Vince, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to get a little bit of clarification. I believe it was Wednesday of this week. You made a statement that in the Old Testament, you couldn't find any scriptures that spoke of consciousness after death. And then I believe it was the following day on Thursday, a caller called in and he had a bunch of scriptures that was talking about the hope of life after death. And it seems to me, and I want to make sure that I'm getting your point of view correctly, it's not so much that in the Old Testament they didn't believe that there was going to be life after death. That was the hope, that the resurrection would come along. And there are passages, like the brother was talking about yesterday, that spoke of the resurrection of the dead. He quoted Job, and he talked about some other passages in the Old Testament. Now, am I correct in assuming that what you were saying on Wednesday was they believed in the resurrection, but as far as consciousness continuing between the moment of death and the moment of resurrection, whenever that will take place, there's no scriptures in the Old Testament that say specifically that there would be consciousness? That's something that we now know because of the New Testament. Am I correct in assuming
yes.
that's what you were saying?
That is my position, right. You know, there is
okay.
one verse right. in the Old Testament. There's one place where one could imagine that it's talking about consciousness in the grave. But I think it's poetic, and I don't think it's really teaching that. It's in Isaiah 14 when it talks about how the king of Babylon will go down into Sheol, and the kings that he's conquered down there will say, "Oh, have you become like one of us?" And so it kind of represents the king of Babylon meeting up with the kings he had killed and cheated, and you know, meeting them in Sheol, and them saying, "Oh, now look at you." But it's an entirely poetic passage, and there's not really strong reason to believe that this formed some defined belief about the afterlife. It's the only place I know of in the Old Testament that could even be taken that way, and I think that because of it's in a poetic passage, we can't argue that it's yeah. teaching it necessarily.
Now, somewhere along the line, that the idea of consciousness after death must have been introduced, because when Jesus is confronting the Sadducees, they're questioning him because they didn't believe in the resurrection, but Jesus says, "You're confused." Because he was talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that God uh-huh. is not a God of the dead, but he's a God of the living. So that idea of consciousness after death had to have been introduced someplace between the Old and the New Testament. Do you know where or how it might have come about?
Well, I think that Jesus points out that it is actually implied way back in Exodus when God said, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And I mean, I don't know if anybody other than Jesus would have drawn that conclusion from that statement. But once Jesus made that statement, I think he's saying, if you're thinking like I am about these things, you would have seen this back there. You know, in other words, he would be saying it can be found in the scriptures, though, you know, the case he gives is far from an obvious outright teaching on the subject. You know, he's kind of inferring it. But, yeah, it is true that belief in the afterlife, that is the continuation of consciousness after death, did enter Judaism very strongly in the intertestamental period, especially about 200 years before the time of Jesus. The rabbis began to adopt some of the stories about the afterlife from Egyptian mythology. There, a very large Jewish population was in Alexandria, Egypt, during that period of time. One of the major Jewish populations outside of Israel was in Alexandria. And some of the stories that the rabbis begin to tell, we have their stories preserved in the Talmud, many of them. And many of their stories are very clear knockoffs of old Egyptian stories from like the Egyptian mythology and from the Book of the Dead and so forth. Also, they began to adopt Greek ideas of the immortality of the soul that had not really been taught clearly in the Old Testament. So, by the time Jesus came, the Jewish rabbis had adopted quite a few notions from elsewhere other than the Old Testament and had reached the view, apart from the Sadducees, the Pharisees had reached the view that there was a continuation of conscious life after death.
It's interesting that some of these, you know, like you said, the Egyptians and the Greeks, although, you know, completely unorthodox in their belief towards one God and what have you, yet existence after death, they had that right. They knew about that.
Well, I wonder, you know, if that's something that's almost intuitive in mankind. You know, if they didn't know it, they might come up with it even, because it only makes sense. I mean, there are people who are not deep thinkers and they just live their life to satisfy their glands and never give any serious thought. But there are philosophical types in every society who thought, you know, the human psyche is something more than just the body. You know, there's got to be something about man that's not just his body. And, you know, the idea that there must be some kind of existence that souls have after death, whether it was true or not would no doubt occur to people. For one thing, there'd be strong wishful thinking. You know, when your family members die or whatever, you'd strongly desire to believe that, you know, they're still alive somewhere and you're going to meet them again someday when you go there too. And I mean, those views I think can be found in many religions. And I think it would be, it would either echo a true intuition that God has given people, or if not, then at least wishful thinking that all people would have. So if it is indeed true, and I think it is, that believers at least continue to live consciously after death, it wouldn't be too surprising to me that other religions would have thought of that. But the thing is, the specific details of where the soul goes down into Hades or Tartarus or whatever that come from the Egyptian and Greek religions are not necessarily things that Jesus would affirm.
Yeah. Now,
the idea that we live on, Jesus could affirm, I think, but the idea that the specific ideas about the nature of Hades or whatever, I don't know that Jesus would affirm all those things.
Yeah. Now, one quick question, I'll let you go. Do you know if within Christendom, if Seventh-day Adventism is the only one that believes in the doctrine of soul sleep?
Well, I don't think they're the only ones. They are they're the main group that has championed the doctrine of soul sleep. But there are other groups. Some of them are Seventh-day groups. Some of them are not. And then there's a lot of individual Christians, individual scholars, who, although they don't represent some denomination that teaches this, a lot of scholars, Christian scholars, are now writing, defending what's called conditional immortality, which is the idea that people are not immortal by nature, and the only way they can become immortal is by coming to Christ. So that would be to a significant degree, would overlap the soul sleep doctrine.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate your time, and you got a great program, brother. We'll keep praying for you, and hope you're on for a long time.
Well, thanks, Vince. I appreciate that. By the way, if you're interested in knowing, you know, who does teach that, there's a book by William Fudge. Yeah, his last name is just like the candy, Fudge. William Fudge. And back, I think, in the 80s, he published a very big book called The Fire That Consumes. And it's a strong defense of conditional immortality. And I think he'd be a believer in soul sleep also. But what's interesting to me is that the introduction to that book, or the preface or whatever, was written by F.F. Bruce. Now, when I saw the book, I had really never heard of Fudge before. I mean, his name didn't carry a lot of authority with me. But F.F. Bruce is a name recognized by all evangelicals. Until his death a few decades ago, he was probably the most respected evangelical scholar alive, and he wrote a favorable preface to this book, saying that Christians ought to take this seriously. So F.F. Bruce confessed himself to be somewhat undecided on the matter, but he at least considered that the view was worthy of being considered seriously. All right, let's talk to Tom from Boulder, Colorado. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to discuss 2 Peter 3:10-12. I called once about a month or so ago about this, and I really wasn't getting the answer. Well, I didn't. I just don't see how that is really being taken into understanding as far as various views of eschatology. Basically, what if that's the next? Basically, whether the return of Christ will be after that event, or if actually the return of Christ will be in conjunction.
Okay. Well, for the sake of those who don't know the passage, this is the passage where Peter says that when the day of the Lord comes, the heavens will be dissolved and the earth will melt with fervent heat, and then that we're looking for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwell righteousness. So that's the passage you're talking about. And what is it you're wondering about it?
Well, does Christ come return in the throes, in the, you know, more speaks forth the new heavens and new earth as a, in result of this, you know, as in the aftermath of this, I guess you'd say, is this the next event on the eschatological calendar? This event?
Well, I think it is. I think it is. Obviously, you're going to find different views. The premillennials would say that the millennium will come first, and then we'll see the end of the present cosmos and the new heavens and new earth. So many Christians will want to put a 1,000-year interim between now and then. But I'm not a premillennialist, and so I believe when Peter said the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, he's talking about the second coming of Christ. And he said, in which, that is, in that day, the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. So Peter seems to be saying that when Jesus returns, like a thief in the night, that's when the earth and the heavens will be burned up. And then he says, okay, in verse 13, nevertheless, right, we look for a new heavens, new earth.
Okay, that's what I was wanting to get there. So, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your call. All right. Bye now. yeah, for those who are not clear on this matter, especially those who may not be real clear on what their eschatological timetable looks like, the popular view today, dispensationalism, and for that matter any premillennialism, believes that Jesus will come back and set up a 1,000-year reign on this earth, and after that 1,000-year reign, then this earth will be dissolved and a new heavens, new earth will come. What I'm suggesting is that Peter doesn't know anything about a millennium. He just says Jesus is going to come back and the heavens and earth are going to be dissolved and there will be new heavens and new earth. And that is the view that was held by the church through most of its history. The idea of a premillennialism is more popular in some circles today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. I hope you have a great weekend. We won't be back with you until Monday, but we will be back as long as the Lord provides for us to pay for the radio time. And we get all that money from people like you. We don't have anything for sale, no sponsors, no commercial breaks. If you want to help us out, you can go to our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. And remember, I'll be in Las Vegas this weekend. The website tells you where and when. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.